Our February 17th show featured a banjo player, Andy Thorne, from a band celebrating 30 years in making glorious bluegrass music, Leftover Salmon. At the same time, a book was being released entitled Leftover Salmon, 30 Years of Festival. The author of that book, Tim Newby, is my guest in the second hour. Tim's written an absolutely fantastic book about 30 years of Leftover Salmon and the changes in the band, changes in the music, and how they've grown and where they're going to grow. And we're going to talk to Tim now that the book is out and available. Tim Newby, author of Leftover Salmon, 30 Years of Festival. I am very pleased to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass, Tim Newby. How are you, Tim?
I'm doing good, Steve. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, I'm so glad to get to connect with you. Tim has written a fabulous book, Leftover Salmon, 30 Years of Festival. It's on Rowan and Littlefield. And you've been kind enough to make sure that I have it for this. And also the publicist, as I was getting ready to talk to Andy Thorne a couple months ago, gave me kind of a draft copy of it. So I've got to peruse it a couple different ways, and now my hard copy, I have post-it notes all over it so we can talk about it. But what a great story. First of all, what a great book. But what a great story that you tell about Leftover Salmon. 30 years is so hard to believe.
Yeah, I mean, they have a great story, so it kind of makes it easy that they have such an interesting story and so many kind of great connections, and, you know, they've done so much, and it makes it kind of easy to tell when there's such a kind of fun story to tell there. You know, I just was lucky enough to kind of get to talk with them and kind of get to share that story with everybody. I think it's a story that maybe isn't as well known as it should be. I think they're a really big influence on a lot of other bands that, you know, maybe might be a little bit bigger now, but, you know, people don't always pay attention to Sam, but I think they're a huge influence, and their stories so huge and so fun and so interesting that I just was, you know, was excited to tell it and felt it needed to be told.
How did you, and I want to talk a little bit about the style that you've chosen, which I think works very well with the paragraph for like, you know, it's titled for each member of the band over the ages, but of course you weave the story of the band in and out of these different paragraphs. But how was it that you first came to be so familiar with Leftover Salmon that you could go directly to Drew Emmett and say, let's start this, and Drew apparently was very, very open and start kick things off for you?
So I had no connection to the band beyond being a fan. I mean, I've seen them at shows, and I've, you know, been up late at shows that they've been, and, you know, seen them dozens of times and stuff like that. But I had interviewed Vince for an article I was writing, and it was going to be a simple article about their High Country album. And as we were talking, he kind of said a few things that really struck me. He said, you know, that we've been doing this for, at the time it was 25 years, but he's like, you know, we've been doing this for, you know, 25 years. And he's like, there's been a lot of changes. He was like, you know, we've had wives come and go, and we've had band members come and go. But he was like, at the end of the day, he was like, you know, it's been, you know, Drew and I kind of always there. At the beginning, we were, you know, pretty footloose and hippie free in the van. And he's like, no matter what, it's always been us. And I thought, man, that's a lot there to think, you know, to spend that much time with somebody and to kind of have all those experiences. And I just kind of was really intrigued by that. And I've been a fan, and I had just recently published my first book and was looking for an idea, and I thought, I'd love to tell this story. And so I had a little bit of connection to their publicist, and I reached out to him and said, I'm interested. And he said, put together a proposal and I'll pass it on to their manager, John Joy. And I put together a proposal and an outline, and I wrote up some samples, and their manager, John Joy, got it. And he called me, and we had this really long, great phone conversation where he asked what my interest was, and I told him, and we had a really good conversation. And he said, let me take it to the band, and he called me back like a week or two later and said, the guys are into it. So that was it, and then they just were kind of on board, and like anything, you know, we developed a relationship over time. I mean, they were very open and willing to help, but, you know, clearly they're a little hesitant at first. They didn't know me, but as we developed a relationship over time, they, you know, asked, they were more willing to give me more information, and, you know, over the course of a couple of years, we got some great stuff, and, you know, I went up to Vince's house for a week, and he literally pulled out all his old Foot Lockers and was just like, go through everything you want, you know, notebooks, calendars, whatever you want, get it, you know. So to see the stuff that's been shut away was really great to kind of have that history and be able to really catalog it. So it was just, you know, that's how it started, and, you know, those guys really bought into it, and were very open and very helpful.
Yeah, it seems to me, in reading the book, I can tell, first of all, it's very, very well cited. I mean, you have citations and footnotes in the back that just go on, so if anybody wants to double check, you borrow from and use, but there's a big, thick section on all of the resources that you use, which I think is always commendable. The other book that you're referring to, I don't want to get away from that too fast. This being your second book, you also wrote Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard Drive and Sound and Its Legacy. and you write for other publications as well. But when you mentioned this, was you'd written one book. That's the one book. So now we have Leftover Salmon, 30 Years of Festival, and we're just starting to get into that a little bit. Here's something. When I talked to Andy Thorne, and I was skimming through the book, and I see this name pop out, and it sort of made sense to me, too, as far as maybe the sound, this very informal and organic sound that Leftover Salmon has always had over the personnel changes. I kept seeing this name pop up, Colonel Bruce Hampton.
I mean, Vince often refers to him as our mentor, our dear leader. You know, I mean, I don't think, you know, Bruce's influence on those guys can be stated enough. I mean, do they play music or sound like Bruce sounded? No. Do they have Colonel Bruce
spirit?
100%. Yeah, 100%. I mean, that idea of playing out and playing with no ego and all that. I mean, the way they talk about Bruce, I mean, Drew wrote Astral Travel after that. I mean, one of the things that really struck me is after Colonel Bruce passed, I was talking with Vince about it, and I was asking, you know, we were kind of talking some other stuff, and I said, what's your favorite musical moment? And he was like, you know, it was that Colonel Bruce show. You know, it was the greatest moment until the end. And I just think that says it right there. It's everything for him. I mean, but Bruce does so much for those guys, and he comes through in so much of their music and how they play and what they do. And I think that his spirit lives in many bands, but Salmon definitely.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm a fan of Colonel Bruce, and I've had the Aquarium Rescue. I've had their records, Aquarium Rescue Unit, and he's formed other different bands. And for the listener, if you're not familiar, get familiar with Colonel Bruce Hampton. I mean, currently, right now, Trucks and Tedeschi. I know Derek spent a lot of time with Colonel Bruce. So it's almost like this is the way you can come through, and you don't have to mimic his style. But I would say for the listeners, for fun, go back and find some Colonel Bruce Hampton, and then you will see this. Salmon is not tracking his sound, but it's that free spirit and courage to go ahead and I don't want to try to make this too deep, but to evolve and to keep evolving and not be afraid to change and bring in, which fits so much, Tim, into the band as the personnel changes make. They were able to adjust to these things, sadly sometimes, but they're able to keep adjusting and improving.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, you're not going to have Salmon without Vince and Drew, right? They're
right.
The soul of everything they do, but, you know, Salmon's really interesting that they have had these sound changes, and it's always been Salmon because at its core you have Vince and Drew being Vince and Drew. I mean, you know, Drew being this amazing guitar, mandolin, fiddle player, and Vince just being the greatest, you know, front man we know. But the fact that they can weave in other banjo players like Noam Patelny and, you know, now Andy Thorne, and they have these different drummers who have different styles. I mean, Michael Wooten played with Carole King, and now Alan Robinson is a jazz guy, and different keyboard players and stuff. I just think the fact that they can tie it all together, it's a little bit of that Bruce vibe there, that we can be out, have no ego, and if we just all are out and have no ego, we're going to be better off for it. And I think, you know, that's Vince and Drew right there with what they've done with Salmon.
Yeah, you start the book off with a nice, as I say, the chapters are named except for the 13th chapter, which is a collection of really great quotes from everybody. But the chapters are named for musicians that have come through the band. And you start off with Drew, and that kind of lays the groundwork for, we talked about a little this off of the air, this thing from the East Coast to the Colorado Sound, and they're right in there with Tim O'Brien, and Tim was a big influence on Drew and Hot Rise and Newgrass Revival, and this whole scene develops in Colorado and Boulder and that area out there, which they're still very much involved in. But without giving away the entire book, yeah, Drew has learned from Tim O'Brien, and he should have, but he's taken it much further. But this thing in Colorado, the sound that exists there, and I always, in my mind, Tim, I always think about you get to the Great Continental Divide and then things change and then you go to California. But right there in Colorado is a whole different vibe and a whole different sound. And Salmon is probably the most pervasive and most influential of the ones that are still there and pushing that sound.
Yeah, you obviously had Hot Rise, who's in the area, who those guys looked up to greatly. But I think the fact that, you know, Salmon took that idea. They took that and you know, Drew's and Vince's love for Sam Bush and Newgrass Revival can't be overstated either. But they took that sound of that bluegrass they loved, but then they said, well, what happens if we throw some drums on here, you know? And that's the thing is, I think Salmon is whatever you are on Sun Essence. If you are a true traditional bluegrass guy, you hear that coming through. If you're a guy who grew up with the Grateful Dead, you hear that influence coming through. If you're a young kid who listened to Fish just getting to Salmon, you hear those influences because they have a little bit of all of that. So I think that they can be whoever you are, and you can find your replacement because they do so much. But I think they took those influences from Hot Rise and Newgrass Revival. I mean, I've always thought it's kind of crazy that you can literally draw a line that goes from, you know, Bill Monroe to the Grateful Dead to Hot Rise, you know, to Newgrass Revival to Colonel Bruce to Salmon, and it's a straight line. You know, there's no deviations, and it's just boom, it goes right to them, you know?
Let me ask you this, since you've written about the Baltimore bluegrass, that East Coast sound, tell me what you, and I always look for words to describe it, I'm not good at it, but the difference, that change between that Baltimore, Washington, East Coast sound to when you're in Colorado, and we just, you just went through a litany of bands that represent that area well, and String Dusters I know are connected throughout, but tell me, what's your, can you capitalize for, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this, but Baltimore bluegrass versus Colorado bluegrass, what can you tell me?
You know, I think maybe the difference with Colorado is when you think of, like, Baltimore, and I'll say D.C., even though my Baltimore friends are going to cringe when I say that because they like to be separated from D.C.
No, it's D.C.
Yeah. You know, like, it's that was a traditional sound. I mean, that was some of the roots of it there. I mean, people kind of forget that, you know, that bluegrass sound migrated out of Appalachia and moved to the cities in Baltimore and Columbus and Dayton and Detroit and stuff. So it came from it. So I think it was a more traditional sound, but then that sound migrated west. So it's going to continue to evolve, and the influences in Colorado are now going to impact it. And somebody who's willing to pack up and move west is going to have a different maybe background, somebody who was moving to Baltimore to look for a job. So you start thinking about different things. And so I think that's the difference there. That's exactly perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't move to Colorado without wanting to be involved in that kind of outdoor lifestyle, and that's going to impact your music. You know, the people who moved to Baltimore to play bluegrass at the time were mostly migrants from Appalachia. They were coming for work. They weren't looking for, you know, skiing and the next good run and to go bouldering and stuff like that. Exactly. So, yeah, I think it's a lifestyle changer.
Although, you know, we'll go ahead and lump D.C. in with the Baltimore thing, but the Seldom Scene, you know, they were – I will bet you any of these people that were influenced by music, at least the selections and the music that the Seldom Scene were pulling in, that influenced everybody at that time, because they were doing things that, although they are regarded as traditional, we'll say East Coast bluegrass, the tunes they were choosing were not.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I talk with enough people through the course of both of my books that, you know, kind of talk about the Seldom Scene, and I mean, I think that's a big draw when you all of a sudden can recognize a song. And maybe it's played in a different style, but you go, wait a minute, I recognize that tune. And then all of a sudden it gives you a little more reason to pay attention to maybe this genre you weren't. I think that's how the Seldom Scene sucked in many new fans.
Because
it was
yeah.
like, I recognize this song. Well, what is this? Oh, this bluegrass stuff isn't so bad. I can kind of get behind this and dig this.
Yeah, they were kind of taking pop tunes and then adding a little twist to them. So younger people then, who are now older people like me, they could hear a song they may have heard on the radio before they got into bluegrass, and now they're hearing a bluegrass version through Seldom Scene. And then I think that freedom also translates into what you would call the Colorado lifestyle and the music that's developed out there. And, you know, Hot Rise being a connection, but then with Newgrass and everything else going on and Leftover Salmon, I think I don't believe that Leftover Salmon, just my opinion here, that – you know, they are the end result. I think they were right there on the ground floor, if not the ground floor, the first floor up, the first set of stairs from Newgrass, and their influence has spread equally well.
Oh, great. And I think they're interesting in that. I mean, I definitely think, you know, that whatever you want to call it, you know, now Jamgrass or whatever, I mean, I think, yeah, absolutely. You know, Newgrass birthed Salmon, which kind of birthed that Jamgrass style, but I think Salmon did the inverse a little bit of what we were saying. You know, the Seldom Scene was introducing this audience to, you know, this older sound. I think Salmon was doing that as well, actually, to a different group of people. They were, you know, they always said that the when they used to play the older, more traditional songs, that got the crowd even more riled up and were going crazy. So they would play some old kind of bluegrass number, and people would kind of jump around and go crazy, and then all of a sudden go, wait a minute, this is some old traditional Bill Monroe tune? Like, what is it? And so instead of, you know, discovering a rock or a pop song, they were now discovering the old traditional and going backwards through Salmon, because Salmon was playing those traditional tunes there, so they were almost doing the inverse kind of a way.
And honestly, Tim, I'm talking to Tim Newby here, who has written a fabulous book, Leftover Salmon, 30 Years of Festival. Tim, that's how it, I think it should. You should go up, and then you should go back, because you want to trace back those things. And if you go to Newgrass through Salmon, let's say backwards, you're going to wind up right in the lap of Bill Monroe and all the bluegrass stuff that came right out of the middle of the country, and then you get the resource with a hyphen, all those things all over again, and then bring yourself mm-hmm. back up. And if you want to keep going, you can do it. You can follow Leftover Sam, which, by the way, I will say this, Tim, their live show currently is flabbergasted. I saw them, they came through Ohio just north of me a couple months ago, and they were all sitting down. I forget what they called it. Was it the front room tour or the living room tour?
The living room. Stories from the living room.
From the living room. And, man, it was fabulous music, and I'd seen them years and years ago, so this was a little bit different for me, but the musicianship and the quality and the presentation and the show that they put on doesn't get lost in the ability to play, but the band that they put on the stage right now is, I think, second to none.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's one of the things that's sometimes lost with Salmon, right? We know they're energetic and they're this amazing live band, but you forget how good they are. I mean, mm-hmm. we know that Drew is an amazing musician on, you know, guitar and mandolin and fiddle, and we forget how good Vince is, and when we get to see him sit down and play like that, it really lets them shine, because you kind of can focus on that, and there's a little bit less of the energy, and then you can also really realize, like, you know, we know how good Andy Thorne is on banjo. I mean, he kind of helped, you know, bring life back to the band, and then, you know, now with Alan Robinson on drums and Eric Deutsch, I mean, then they really get to shine. You got Eric Deutsch on grand piano, which is just one of the greatest things
you
can hear, and you know, Alan's drums really come through because it's just everybody's, you know, so clear and crystal. And then, you know, the rock as it's been for the last 20 years is Greg, and he's playing an upright bass. And I just, you know, you love that. And you forget how good of musicians they are, because normally they're just energetic, you know.
You're right. And Vince is so happy. And Vince is having such a good time, you forget the level that he's performing at. I think it's so easy for him. And I think, and then you know, we'll use the word, jam band or jam grass, which I don't know why it has a pejorative term. I don't, maybe it's just the way I hear it spoke back to me. But mm-hmm. to me, that's a wonderful sound, and I don't want people to take that and think that, like you just made the point a minute ago, I'm just parroting you, that people think maybe that's, you know, you can just describe Leftover Salmon as a jam band. And you could, but when you see them, you realize they're not just up there taking extended breaks on things just because they can and because everybody's in a happy mood. The playing is just as good as, well, Drew's as good a mandolin player as there is. Start there where you start in the book. And you mentioned Andy, the current banjo player. I've played banjo for a long time. Andy is one of the best banjo players I've ever seen or heard.
Yeah, I mean, they're great, and I do. I feel that jam band title can sometimes have negative connotations, and I'm a kid who, you know, I listen to Fish, and I listen to that, and I get it, and I actually do talk about that in the book, that idea that name is negative, but it shouldn't be. It's the scene, and the scene should represent this. It doesn't have to be somebody just endlessly noodling up there with nowhere to go. Like, it's talking about, you know, a style and an emotion and playing loose and free and changing up your set. So it doesn't mean that we just get up there and, you know, meander through 19-minute, like, you know, solos that have no meaning. It means that we play with different ideas on stage, and maybe it's like Salmon, where that different ideas, we're going to add drums to bluegrass, and we're going to play an old traditional song really fast. It doesn't have to be a 35-minute jam. That, to me, is still a jam band, somebody who's just taking the music and taking chances with it.
I'm with you on that. I want to lift the veil off of this jam band. I keep combining jam grass and jam band. I want to lift the veil off of that. It's a positive thing. And anyone out there who has any questions about the connotations behind it, please see Leftover Salmon live when you can, because you'll come away thinking, okay, now I get it. Because like you said, the drums and the grand piano, and he does things on the piano that I've seen a lot of music outside of bluegrass, Tim. He does things on piano that I've never heard of before.
And he's got, you know, he's not necessarily like this, you know, bluegrass guy. I mean, bluegrass piano is exactly a pretty limited field.
There's not many. Bruce Horn's.
yeah. But, you know, Eric's background, I mean, he has this long, extensive background. He's been doing it for a long time, so he's bringing in different influences as well, which I think is great. Like,
absolutely.
You don't have to go say, hey, let's go find a guy who can play bluegrass.
Yeah.
You know, let's go find a guy who's a good piano player and keyboard player and make it. I mean, Alan's a jazz guy. I mean, like he says, he knew nothing of this music. He's learned all of this as he joined. Like, if you get a good drummer in a good band, it's going to work. You don't have to find a bluegrass guy.
He
you know?
Kicks at the drums, just kick it. I spent a couple tunes just making sure that I focused on the drumming and the piano, because I knew there was something special going on. And so if you really just focus on either one for, let's say, 30 seconds or a minute or more of a particular song, you realize right away that they're Everybody's complimenting each other. No one is. It's all for this sound, and they're all playing at an exceptionally high level and creating this sound of Leftover Sammy. It's not an accident. It's virtuosity, mm-hmm. and they're freed up. But it all fits within the scheme. Nobody's saying, "Hey, look at me."
Well, then it's easy to kind of focus on Drew or focus on Vince up front. You know,
right.
But you gotta pause and say, "Well, let's go see what Andy's doing, or let's go see what Alan or Greg or Eric's doing," because they are just so rock solid, and that's why right now. I mean, they've always been great live, but why coming up on year 30 that they can just be as good as now as they were in 1989 and 1990 and 1994 or 97, you know, it's amazing.
Can you tell me a little bit, Mark Vann, where the book, is the way I read it, there's so many things that happened to the band as a result of Mark Vann, the original banjo player, I think, and then his unfortunate passing, and then the efforts after that, and then they shut it down for a while.
You know, I mean, I think his spirit is with the band and over the band always. I mean, I think he was such an influence on the early days. I mean, he was a very strong personality and you know, kind of shaped things that they did. And the fact that he came from such a real traditional kind of background and didn't have much knowledge outside of that, so, like, all of a sudden that helped shape their sound, because it wasn't like he was a banjo guy who knew rock. I mean, they used to joke that, like, you know, a song would come on and be like, "Who's this?" And they'd be like, "It's the Beatles," you know? So I think that kind of helped shape their sound, you know, the stuff you do in those days. And he was also a strong personality and kind of helped push them forward, because he was a really strong business mind. But then his spirit continues, because, you know, he did unfortunately pass and they had to go through some rough times. But then they came out, you know, strong on the other side when they found Andy. So I think that everything they do, he's always kind of there, still kind of pushing along.
And that's what I mean by, I think, the theme throughout. Not that his passing is, but I feel like there's a spirit. There's a spirit of so many of them, but I think in the book, and I think from the music too, that Mark is always there, whether it's Gnome or whether it's Andy or whoever's coming in at that spot. I get the feeling from the discussions with the other original band members or the long-term band members that Mark is always right there.
Mm-hmm. It is, you know, and I know Andy had talked about he was stepping into some kind of big shoes there, and you know, he didn't directly replace Mark,
right.
But he kind of knew. But Andy was also in a different position. He kind of felt that he filled that role because he had a really good relationship with Vince and Drew, and that was the other side of it. It wasn't just musical, but it was the fact that, like, Vince and Drew had this kind of third personality foil on stage there, and all of a sudden Andy could also fill that. You know, it wasn't just that he could play; it was all of it. Like, how does he fit in? And Andy kind of was the perfect personality for that as well. So, you know, it was a lot about Mark. It wasn't just he was an amazing banjo player; it was his personality in the band, and how do you even begin to fill those shoes?
That's I think the spirit that I feel through the band and through the book, as you explain and elaborate. I may have been able to pick up on that, but the way you pull it through in the book, I will tell you this again, Tim, that. The book is not just a historical account. It's, you know, so this happened this day. You're a really good writer. I told you this off the air. You're a really good writer. You write. It's intriguing. If someone who didn't even want to know about the evolution of bluegrass or whatever that means, or Leftover Salmon for 30 years, it's a good book to read if you're just a fan of reading.
Well, I really appreciate that, Steve. That means a lot. That's great to hear you say.
I hope that, I guess if people... you were traveling with them for a while. I think are they going back out? Are they off a tour now? They're going to come back out for a while.
So they have their summer dates, and they'll do a lot of festivals and kind of those one-offs there. And then I don't know what their plan is for the fall right now. I'm sure they're going to announce that here soon. But yeah, they'll be out. They have tons of festival dates. I mean, you can't have festival season in the summer without
right.
Sam. And then I know they're playing the Ryman end of June and stuff, so they're going to kind of continue.
Are they going to Grey Fox? They're going to Grey Fox.
I think so. I think they are.
I think so.
Yeah.
I'm always up there running around. They give me free rein, although I don't know why yet, but I haven't let them take my passport away. I just run around everywhere, so I think they're going to be there.
Don't complain about getting free rein.
No. We'll take that part out. But I know that you've traveled with them a lot. And the book is available if you're on the scene. It's available even if you're not at a concert. I know at the merch table it's available. And so people can get it from you if you show up there, or they can get it if not. But if they're there, they can talk to you a little more about it. And then as they decide to buy it, they can get a book from you. It's probably also available on a website. Or how would people purchase it?
I mean, you can get it anywhere. I mean, you can get it through the publisher, Roman and Littlefield. It's available on Amazon, any major bookseller online. you can find it, and it's in some stores. I don't know which stores. You know, it's obviously different stores, but you can, you know, find it in some stores as well. But it's pretty easy to find. If you just put in Leftover Salmon 30 Years of Festival, you'll get a bunch of different options up there to be able to order it and, you know, get it from the band, or go to a show and get it from them and get a chance to talk with them and have them sign it as well.
That'd be cool. It's a wonderful book about a wonderful band, or a wonderful story about a wonderful band. I don't want to and didn't want to go through the entire story as we go, because why would people buy the book? Not that I would cover every page of it, but the structure is as we described. There's a player by player by player, and then it's all woven together, and then things happen to the band. I think the very last chapter of just quotes is just a neat way to go back, and you can have to read that all the time, but you can go back and read it if you want to just flip back and see some. But the layout of the book, and the writing, and the story that's told, and the way it's pulled together with all the citations and resources, my gosh, there's pages, there's like 20 pages of, and then there's a discography and DVDs available and lives. I mean, this is pretty much a book that will describe everything anybody would want to know about this incredible band of 30 years of festival, Leftover Salmon. It's really well done. I appreciate that so much, your effort.
My college history professor would be so excited to hear you say that. And my bibliography was well put together. He'd be so excited to hear that.
Well, that's always the thing that we hate to do, but you know what? When you do it and you do it right, and it's really nicely laid out, it gives people. We were talking a little bit about how you go to Salmon and you go back, or you might go forward and pull it forward, but it gives people a chance to go back and read these sources, because you quote and you use a lot of good, credible sources for it. So that it's really good that you do that.
Well, I think it's sort of like we were talking about kind of off the air as well, as they have so many other connections that if you're interested and want to hear some more of the story, I mean, it's great to have that connection there. And that was sort of the thought to kind of jump to a different thing here. But you were talking about that last chapter with all those different quotes. You know, part of that idea was, as I talked with these people, there was just so much love and so many people like had so much to say about it. I was like, I wanted to make sure that came across. But then I also wanted to make sure that it came across like this completely diverse range of musicians. You know, I mean, that was the point. If you look at it, and it's not just bluegrass guys.
Nope.
I mean, you have people from the jam band world and this world and, you know, old rock world and traditional bluegrass guys. Like, I just wanted to make sure clear that everybody from all these different fields has these feelings about them and what they've taken from it. And that last chapter was really important to kind of put in there, that I felt that I wanted to make it clear how much these other bands kind of looked up to them, and bands who they look up to still look up to Salmon, even though they had an influence on Salmon. You know, I just thought it was important to kind of make sure that was in there.
It is, and we'll tell you this too, for the people listening, if you're not a bluegrass fan, in which case, why are you listening to this program? But if you're not and you happen to stumble across it, you're going to find people that you know from other, you made a good point there, of other types of music that have comments that are well-reasoned comments, because they know of Leftover Salmon that maybe you would have never seen in a bluegrass setting, but it just shows the wide swath that they've cut with the music over 30 years.
I mean, they did an album with David Lowery from Cracker. I mean, you know, that was in Camp Van Beethoven. I mean, but, you know, I think that the parallels between Camper Van Beethoven and Leftover Salmon are right on, right? You have a punk band that had a fiddle and a bluegrass band with a drum. I mean, the parallels are so similar. They just go about it a little differently with what they sound like. But, you know, I just think that there's so much, you know, so many things that they kind of got their fingers into out there.
They did, and everybody knows it, and now everybody's going to know more about its great book, Leftover Salmon, 30 Years of Festival, which, by the way, Vince screams Festival at some point during the concert. He'll just scream out Festival, and everybody gets, you know, that's a trigger point. It's like a Skinner thing. Everybody kind of reacts to that and moves on. But Tim Newby, this is great, man. Thanks so much for being available and sharing your thoughts on this book. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for this. I really appreciate you taking some time to talk about this with me.
Sure, man. Listen, I'll let you get back to your life, and the audience doesn't need to know this, but I know you're recovering from, you weren't hurt skiing. Andy was, but what did you do?
So I tore my meniscus. I'm a referee for college lacrosse, so I did it doing a game. I tore my meniscus, and I guess it pulled off with the bone, so they had to kind of drill in my bone and to reattach it down, so I've been on crutches for like 4 weeks.
Oh, man. Gee, how old are you now, Tim?
I am 44. I'll be 45 next month.
These things didn't happen to us when we were 24 and 25.
No,
I'm just telling
no.
you, there's a change that happens in your body, because I can remember 44, but just barely, but I'm just telling you that. You know, things like that, just like, well, how did that happen? It never happened before, but I'm glad you're healing. I think you're doing fine, and from what you've told me off of the air, everything's right on schedule.
Yeah, I think I'll be off the crutches like next week. So a couple more days, we'll be good to go, and then start walking around again.
Cool. All right, man. Listen, thanks, Tim. I will. I'll talk to you later. Maybe catch you down the road somewhere if you're traveling with Sam and on some tour.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely, man. Great. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us.
Sure, man.
A lot.
Yeah. Thanks. I'll talk to you later.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
Later.